The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth. In 2015, New Mexico abolished a controversial practice known as civil forfeiture. Critics of the reform claimed it would increase crime and make the state's residents worse off. 5 years later, IJ examined that claim in the latest edition of its seminal report on civil forfeiture, Policing for Profit. I'm here today with one of the report's authors, IJ Senior Research Analyst Jenny McDonald, as well as IJ Senior Attorney Wesley Hoddit. We're going to talk about civil forfeiture, the report, and what states can do to protect innocent people. Jenny, I'd like to start by talking about New Mexico because it is such a great case study of so many different aspects of forfeiture, as well as the issues that you tackle in the report. But first, for people who aren't familiar, can you briefly explain what civil forfeiture is?
Civil forfeiture is a legal tool that allows police and prosecutors to take and keep people's property without ever charging them with a crime. Making that even worse, most states and the federal government allow agencies to keep most, if not all, of the proceeds that they gain from forfeiture. And that creates a direct financial incentive to police for profit.
And we'll get into the broader findings of Policing for Profit later in the conversation. But just, again, for a little bit of context, you did find that this was big business, right?
It's huge business. It's a massive nationwide problem. Since 2000, states and the federal government have forfeited at least $68.8 billion. And we know that that number, while huge, is actually an undercount because we don't have a full 20 years of data for all 50 states. So we're talking much more than $68 billion forfeited.
So I mentioned that in 2015, New Mexico reformed its law. Can you talk about what things look like in New Mexico today post-reform? What is the law there?
Now, New Mexico doesn't have civil forfeiture at all. So that means that when police and prosecutors think that property was involved in a crime, the determination of whether to forfeit it happens alongside the defendant's criminal case. So just like the defendant has to be proven guilty of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt, prosecutors also have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that property either facilitated or is proceeds from that crime. Making it even better, New Mexico also removed the financial incentive by directing all forfeiture proceeds to the state's general fund. And so that removes law enforcement's direct financial incentive to engage in forfeiture.
And this is very different from what things looked like prior to the reform. And Wesley, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what things were like in New Mexico pre-2015. IJ was really involved there. We had a couple of lawsuits and what did it look like before things got better?
Police and prosecutors were allowed to seize property off the street based on probable cause. Most often it's a vehicle, but frequently it will be cash or other monetary instruments, sometimes even homes, lawful firearms, things like that. And prosecutors then can keep that property and sell it for their own benefit using civil forfeiture processes, as Jenny just described. Law enforcement was allowed to keep 100% of the proceeds of the property that they seized and successfully forfeited in New Mexico, just as is the case at the federal level and in most states today. And what we were seeing in New Mexico is what you would expect to see with those kinds of incentives. A robust forfeiture machine that was so out of control that local prosecutors, for example, the Las Cruces district attorney, would put on training sessions for police where they said, you know, go after the liquid assets, the cash, the expensive cars, the things that are easy to sell. Do not seize jewelry or late model vehicles or something like that. These things are difficult to sell. And humans follow incentives. And I don't blame police and prosecutors for following the incentives that are laid out for them in the law. What New Mexico recognized was that the law was the problem.
And they were one of the things that I found personally so outrageous in New Mexico is that they actually would build it into the budget for the city, which, you know, you're talking about the incentives there. I mean, at that point, if you don't seize the property, potentially you have to fire people, or I mean, that seems like a really terrible position to put a police officer who actually wants to focus on something like crime rather than raising revenue.
Yeah, that's so important. And I'm glad you mentioned it. In an era when it's politically unpopular on both sides of the aisle to impose general taxes on people, the federal government has largely encouraged this kind of activity at the state level to fund law enforcement. I mean, these were some of the animating concerns of Magna Carta back in the 13th century. The concerns have revealed themselves time and again. They were instrumental to the English Bill of Rights and the American Bill of Rights. And somewhere between the mid-1980s and today, we've forgotten those lessons of history in the context of civil forfeiture.
So you have the sort of these animating principles playing out in New Mexico exactly as you would envision. The district attorney that you or the city attorney that you described was caught on camera, right? Because it was a training that was recorded and posted because this was just so commonplace that it didn't occur to them that it might be controversial, perhaps. Once that broke in the New York Times, that was the impetus for the reforms in 2015. But prior to those reforms, IJ had a case there. After the reforms, IJ had a case there. Could you talk a little bit about the second lawsuit? It seems like after they change the law, they recognize the problem, they fix it. What else is there to sue about?
Before the reforms, we sued in a situation that's very similar to what we see around the country even today, where a mother's son had borrowed her vehicle, driven it while intoxicated. It was a fairly valuable vehicle. And so the city of Albuquerque seized it from him and forfeited it from her in order to raise revenue. Now, the law made that impossible, as Jenny's described. But the city of Albuquerque refused to follow that new law. And we had to sue a second time to enforce what the New Mexico legislature had passed. You know, their position was, well, the state legislature can't tell us what to do about law enforcement in our city, which, of course, was incorrect. We were successful in both cases. And I'm excited to say that now we're in front of other courts, most notably the South Carolina Supreme Court, making the exact same arguments we made in those cases and advocating for the end of the profit incentive in South Carolina.
So the lawsuit, successful, both of them, the law has changed. It's finally enforced. Law enforcement, as you mentioned, they weren't happy to follow it. One of the things that came up over and over during litigation, during the conversation about the changing the law, was the idea that these kinds of reforms are a gift to criminals. And that was something that, you know, because it comes up so often, it came up in New Mexico and it comes up elsewhere in South Carolina and other places, we really wanted to dig into. And Jenny, that was something that you took the lead on in this new report. And I wondered if you could discuss what you found.
When law enforcement is opposing civil forfeiture laws, they often threaten that, you know, reducing civil forfeiture will increase crime because it will no longer deter criminals or punish them. And it will also reduce law enforcement's ability to fight those crimes by taking resources away from them. So if that is true, we would expect to see crime rates rise and arrest rates drop. And so we decided to put that to the test in New Mexico. We looked at crime rates 2.5 years before the reform went into effect and 2.5 years after it went into effect. And we compared those rates to those in Colorado and New Mexico, states that are similar and nearby to New Mexico, to see if the reform really changed things in New Mexico compared to other states. And we found absolutely no effect. We found absolutely no increase in crime rates, no decrease in overall arrest rates. And so what we found is evidence to suggest that the argument that forfeiture is a meaningful tool to fight crime just doesn't hold water.
So zooming back then from New Mexico, one of the other key pieces of this report, you know, which took 5 years, I believe, to put together, is an analysis not just of New Mexico, but all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and the federal government. Could you talk about what it is that you were examining as you looked at each of those states? How do you compare apples to apples? What are you looking for in analyzing the laws there and ultimately ranking the laws?
So we look at three key aspects of civil forfeiture law. The first being the standard of proof. So how hard do prosecutors have to work to prove property's connection to a crime in order to forfeit it? In most states and the federal government, that standard is preponderance of the evidence. And that means they only have to prove that it's more likely than not that the property's connected to a crime in order to forfeit it. We also looked at when there is an innocent owner involved. So the case, like Wesley said, where the son had the car seized from him, but the car actually belonged to the mother who did nothing wrong. Most states put the burden on the mother, on that innocent owner, to prove that she did nothing wrong in order to get her property back. And the last thing we looked at is that financial incentive that I talked about. You know, what percentage of forfeiture revenues remain with police and prosecutors? And the vast majority of states and the federal government allow agencies to keep 100% of the proceeds. So while there are other idiosyncrasies and differences across states in their forfeiture laws, we looked at those three specific things in order to compare state laws. And we found that most states, you know, really fail to make the grade.
Yeah, so stepping back, overall, what were some trends that you observed as you looked at as you look across states? I mean, if you're examining the same things from state to state, were there any trends that you observed?
You know, overall, the report provides strong evidence that forfeiture just doesn't work. It doesn't fight crime. It doesn't target big-time criminal kingpins. And it doesn't support crime victims or community programs. We know that forfeiture is not targeting criminals, one, because the New Mexico analysis shows that, you know, forfeiture doesn't fight crime, but also because we were able to look at the average forfeiture size in 21 states that provided us with enough data. And we found that half of all currency forfeitures are worth less than $1,300. So this isn't the Bernie Madoffs and the El Chapos of the world that the government loves to tout when they're talking about, you know, the success of their forfeiture program. This is, you know, often innocent people who just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, Pennsylvania had the lowest median forfeiture value at just $369. So we're really not talking about large cartels that these forfeiture laws are targeting. And, you know, another trend, we looked at how agencies are spending these forfeiture proceeds. Governments also love to talk about how they use their forfeiture proceeds to invest in community programs like DARE and other anti-drug programs, how they can use forfeiture proceeds to, you know, compensate victims of crime. But when we looked at the 13 states that provided us with expenditure data, we found that in 2018, agencies spent almost nothing on victims, and just 9% of their expenditures went to community programs on average. So to the extent that law enforcement says forfeiture is important because it fights crime, targets criminals, and supports communities and victims, the report finds that that's just not true. The data just don't support those claims.
And now other reports suggest that as budgets get tight, for all of the reasons that we've discussed, you know, kind of throughout the program, there's a strong incentive to engage in more forfeiture. And that's, in fact, what law enforcement seems to do. As, you know, as Wesley mentioned, taxes are not very popular. This can be kind of a below-the-radar way to make up perhaps budget shortfalls. So given that right now, as we look ahead to 2021 and beyond, and we're still in the kind of throes of the pandemic and the economic consequences of that, it seems pretty reasonable that forfeiture and perhaps an increase in forfeiture is something that we should be concerned about. So given that and given what you know from the report, Wesley, what are the targets for groups like IJ, for our allies, as we look to try to curtail these kinds of abuses of property rights and of innocent owners?
Well, there are a lot of targets. I mean, the big fish in this sea is, of course, the federal government. The federal government really got civil forfeiture going. It has aggressively poured fuel onto the growth of civil forfeiture since the mid-1980s. And the federal government is and will remain IJ's top priority in terms of changing the law. A lot of dominoes tend to fall based on what Congress does. But as I'm sure listeners know, Congress doesn't do much. And although we've been pursuing this aggressively for nearly 10 years now, I think it's very important that we also have an aggressive strategy at the state level. And New Mexico proves that. There are a few states. We've talked about New Mexico, but North Carolina and Oklahoma also have some really excellent recent reforms. They tend to come from a groundswell of public outrage that is generated when someone brings a case challenging forfeiture. And I would say in brief, the strategy today is keep pressing Congress. You know, there are a few members in every Congress who care about this issue and are willing to have hearings. We should take every opportunity we have to put the faces and the victims of forfeiture in front of Congress. Second, we should have an aggressive state strategy. And I think, you know, like, to a guy with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But I think that starts with litigation, because you need an example of someone that people can relate to who's been victimized by these procedures. That puts you in a position where lawmakers will listen, because they're hearing from their constituents that they don't like this.
So with that in mind, are you, as you look at the states, you're maybe not looking then for the states with the worst policing for profit grades based on the law, but perhaps on enforcement, where more and more people are falling victim and producing those kinds of stories that illustrate the problem?
You know, our top priority, and this is what puts the federal government at the top of the list, is how much forfeiture activity is going on. That indicates two important things, if not more. One thing it shows us is that they do this a lot, so they're going to overdo it. The other is that it really is a self-perpetuating mechanism. More forfeiture just begets more forfeiture. And so yes, you put at the top of the list the jurisdictions where there's a lot of forfeiture activity.
As you go on the ground and are talking to the allies that you mentioned or legislators, have you noticed that the reaction today is different than it was in 2014, 2015 in New Mexico, for instance? Are you getting the same kind of responses like, well, of course, this is going to be a gift to criminals. This is going to increase crime. It's going to make people less safe. Or is the kind of research that groups like IJ in particular are doing starting to reach these people? Jenny, have you noticed that? Or
absolutely. There has been an increasing trend in favor of forfeiture reform. Most Americans support forfeiture reform. And we are starting to really make some good inroads with some of the more law and order legislators. You know, police unions and associations are a very powerful lobby at the state and the federal level. And so we really have our work cut out for us when we oppose them, you know, and say that, you know, actually, these reforms are not going to worsen public safety. And, you know, we're starting to see that. You know, we've seen more than half of the states adopt some sort of forfeiture reform since the last edition of Policing for Profit. Huge inroads in transparency so that we're able to talk about, you know, just how often this is going on, how they're spending the proceeds and things like that. So I think we're definitely moving in the right direction, but we've still got our work cut out for us. You know, let's not forget that over the last 20 years, the federal government paid out almost $9 billion in equitable sharing payments, you know, so it really is big business and it's a tough fight, but I think IJ is definitely up for the challenge.
Well, thank you both for taking the time to be here today and to talk through this issue and the report. If you enjoyed the conversation and would like to learn more about forfeiture and about what Policing for Profit says, I urge you to check it out, and we will include a link in the show notes. If you enjoyed today's conversation and would like to hear more deep dives, you can find them on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to subscribe.